public hate. Still to our hearts, we do public hate. Dirty music, we do public hate. Hey everybody, welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and we've got a great show for you lined up today. Anthony Gregory from LouRockwell.com will be here, and in the second hour we'll be talking with Tom Barry from, it used to be called the Inter-Hemispheric Resource Center, now it's the International Relations Center, and I've interviewed Tom Barry before, he's a great guy. So stay tuned for that. Let me say that the website is weekendinterviewshow.com if you want to hear any of the archives. And you can send me email there, scott@weekendinterviewshow.com or scott@antiwar.com. I've only written about 4 articles for them so far, but I'm working on some more. And I want to say for anybody here in the local Austin area, you're going to go downtown and get drunk tonight at the South by Southwest. Make sure and stop by the Best Worst. They sell the best worst right there at 6th and San Jacinto. My friend John, thanks for the T-shirt, dude. There's your plug. And I also want to say that it's the second anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, Operation Shock and Awe, Decapitation Strike, and so forth, started 2 years ago. And I read the polls recently say that Americans think that Iraqis are much better off now. Well, apparently they don't seem to think so. In fact, the security situation in Iraq is a complete disaster. And it's going to be pretty hard for me to play devil's advocate with my first guest here after saying this. The Iraq war has wasted $157 billion. 1,521 American soldiers have been killed. 11,344 officially, but perhaps as many as 20,000 have been wounded. At an absolute minimum, according to IraqBodyCount.com, 17,000 Iraqi civilians have lost their lives. 17,000 individual Iraqis civilians have lost their lives. We've proven to the world that we're a paper tiger, that, yeah, we can shock and awe and invade your country, but we can't even hold on to it for 3 months. Got our guys hiding in barracks and behind their green zone walls. They don't even control that third-rate country that we had destroyed through sanctions for over a decade after the first Gulf War. So we've shown the whole world how weak America really is. No superpower at all. Thank you very much. We've completely debased our currency. We have all the Asian central banks beginning to seriously think twice about investing in our worthless bonds any longer. We fulfilled what Osama bin Laden calls Operation Bleed America Dry. Bleed America until they're bankrupt, trick them into invading country after country until their empire collapses, as all empires do. And we've gone for it 100%. Former CIA analyst Michael Scheuer, the formerly anonymous author of Imperial Hubris, Porter Goss, the new director of Central Intelligence, the CIA's National Intelligence Council, and other anonymous CIA and named former CIA people have been all over the media saying that the invasion of Iraq has made everything better for Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups who would like to target Americans. And that Porter Goss, in fact, testified before the Senate less than a month ago that Iraq will be a terrorist training camp for years and years to come. The CIA did a report looking forward to 2020 and said that that area of Mesopotamia will be turning out terrorists at least through then. And the Iraq war is a complete disaster. It's been 2 years, and the vast majority of the American people fell for it. How many times did you hear somebody say, well, I say we just go in there and get Saddam and get out? Yeah, well, thanks a lot, because what you did was you justified them going in there to get Saddam and stay forever. Even Hillary Clinton, the so-called opposition in the United States Senate, is apparently very comfortable with the idea of the American military occupying that land for up to 50 years, just like Europe and Japan after the Second World War. So thanks a lot. Anyway, it's a Weekend Interview Show. We'll be right back to talk with Anthony Gregory from LouRockwell.com. Take care. ride, my friends. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. Our first guest today is Anthony Gregory. Welcome, Anthony.
Hi.
Hey, it's great to have you back.
Here. Yeah.
Hey, everybody, Anthony Gregory is one of the most prolific libertarian writers in existence. He writes for the Independent Institute, where he's a research assistant. He also writes for antiwar.com, lewrockwell.com. He's a policy advisor and writer for the Future Freedom Foundation. Also writes for Rational Review, the Libertarian Enterprise, Liberty Magazine, and Strike the Root. So please make sure to check Anthony's articles, particularly at Strike the Root and lewrockwell.com. Well, and I should say that also I'm proud that Anthony is a good friend of mine. So if I sound like I'm arguing with him, it's BS because me and him are pals. And I can vouch for Anthony that he was against the war before it was cool. Isn't that right?
Well, I guess so. I did a piece for the Independent Institute when I was an intern back before the war started, and I said, "Here's some, you know, these are unbelievable reasons for war, and all this stuff about weapons of mass destruction. Not that they would validate the war, but they didn't seem to really be legitimate, considering what we were hearing from CIA and from Scott Ritter, and of course." Everyone that was supposedly a traitor and a sodomite was right. Now, it's really a pleasure, Scott, to be on this show on the two-day anniversary of Iraqi freedom. I mean, nothing warms my heart more than going around and exporting freedom by killing people.
Yeah, well, there's flowers and candy all over the street.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and, you know, this is really why I brought you on, the exporting freedom with warfare. And, you know, obviously, I can only play devil's advocate because clearly I don't believe in this kind of garbage. However, I want to try to you know, in a reasonable fashion, try to state the case of the liberventionists, you know, particularly the case of George Bush, who says that, listen, the reason we have all these enemies is because these people live in these backwards, you know, three centuries behind tyrannies, and they're not free, and so they're angry, and they're poor, and they're desperate, and so they resort to acts of terror. And that if we can liberate these countries and bring them into the 21st century and help show them liberty and self-rule, self-government, and free markets, that we won't have a terrorist problem anymore. And we'll all live in harmony now. And that's the mission that our government is now on. And I hope I didn't state that in a way to, you know, just make it sound silly, because it really does kind of sound silly. But
well, it does sound it's ludicrous. I mean, there's unfree countries throughout the world. The ones that are hostile to us, the ones that have people who are hostile and who are willing to fund terrorism, are, you know, they're ones where the U.S. government has intervened, has overthrown governments, has fixed elections, has killed innocent people, has sanctioned trade. A lot of times, you know, the U.S. goes in and intervenes and overthrows the government, puts in a worse one, or puts in one that's not clearly better. And of course, in the case of Iran, which was kind of the beginning of the heavy-duty U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East during the Eisenhower administration, the U.S. overthrew a democratically elected government and put in the Shah. And the U.S. has overthrown democratically elected governments in Chile and Guatemala and put in non-democratic leaders. Now, the thing to remember is just because someone's democratically elected doesn't mean that the regime is going to be liberal in the classic sense. It can be very repressive. But in this whole thing about freedom, we need to export freedom. First of all, it's not working very well. Iraq isn't any freer now. It doesn't. I've seen no evidence that they're freer. There's certainly a lot of people who have been liberated from their lives, but Saddam was a monster, and the U.S. should have never helped him rise to power, and it should have never funded him during the 1980s, during his worst crimes against humanity. But even though he was a monster, it was one of the more liberal, less repressive Arab regimes in the Middle East. You know, people drank alcohol, for what it's worth. There was gun ownership. That was before the police, the Iraqi police that are allied with the U.S. state now, went around, rounded up guns in Baghdad but you know, women wore what they wanted to wear, more or less. I wouldn't want to live there, I don't think, and it's certainly not as free a country as I think all countries should be. But this whole idea of going around and spreading freedom so people won't hate us, it's this kind of hubris, that thinking that the U.S. can engineer freedom throughout the world, that causes so many people to hate us. You look at the polls, they don't hate us because we wear T-shirts or because we, you know, listen to rock music or any of that stuff, or that we drink Coke or Pepsi. It's the foreign policy of the U.S. government that they hate. That's the thing that's killing people.
Well, but I think, Anthony, you have the same misunderstanding that many people in the Middle East have, which I think is why they hired Karen Hughes to help make this clear in a way that people can understand better, and that is that Bush has repudiated the past of supporting dictatorships and supporting people who were cruel to their own in order to secure America's interests. And he said that he feels really bad about that. And in fact, there were some who interpreted his statements as even being a direct repudiation of his father, talking about, you know, we were willing to sacrifice the liberty of people in the Middle East for our balance of power politics. And those days are over. Now we really mean it. We're bringing you freedom.
Well, there's this wonderful book by James Bovard, Terrorism and Tyranny. And there's a chapter about terrorism and tyranny and how the U.S. government is allies with a lot of the more repressive regimes. Sure, you know, Bush could say that he's not making the same mistake that he did up to 9/11 by continuing support for the Taliban, for example. But, you know, the U.S. is still allied with some very brutal regimes. This is all balderdash that he's repudiating this.
What kind of arguments do you get in with what you call the liberventionists, people who are self-identified libertarians and yet support this war?
Well, the
libertarian adventure.
The funny thing is, after 9/11 and all the way up to the Iraq War, the liberventionists who, you know, endorsed the war, the arguments seem mainly to be one of national security, one of, you know, we need to protect Americans from this impending threat that supposedly existed. It was very, it was centered on the idea that, you know, we'll have to kill some innocent Iraqis, but that's not as important as saving the lives of innocent Americans. And you get this kind of argument that Americans, their lives, you know, they're worth more. But on the other hand, after the whole weapons of mass destruction and terrorist threat from Iraq, all of those supposed justifications kind of fell through. Now it's a much more internationalist argument. It's that we need to sacrifice. You know, we shouldn't cringe at the idea of losing 1,500 of our people to bring freedom to Iraq. You know, we have to make big sacrifices. And it's a much more kind of Wilsonian, you know, argument, and it's based on the idea that Americans need a sacrifice. Of course, most of the people who make these arguments aren't people who are making the sacrifice. The people who are dying are American servicemen and women and foreigners. They're not the people who. It's really odd to hear people give these cost and benefit analysis and calculations on how many of us it's worth to lose to save their liberty, which never materializes. I mean, government is a very failed, inefficient institution. Anyone who understands free market economics understands the failures of central planning, the nature of spontaneous order, the fact that most things we value in society, commercially and culturally, they emerge from the bottom up and through voluntary exchange between individuals. Using a socialist institution like the U.S. military to bring freedom abroad. It's paradoxical. It doesn't work very well.
And it brings with it, like you say, collectivist ideas, socialistic ideas, like ends justifying means. In fact, just a couple of days ago, I read a quote from Bill Kristol where they were asking him if the Iraq War is worth it or was it worth it. And he says, well, it remains to be seen in the end how the situation turns out. Then we'll know whether it was worth it or not.
Yeah, that's it's really interesting that we'll know when we calculate the loss in terms of other people's lives, but also our freedom. You know, war has always been bad for liberty at home. And this is, the current administration is the biggest government administration we've had since the Vietnam War Great Society years. And you were talking about, you know, free markets and bringing the idea of liberal democracy abroad. The U.S., the United States is a lot less free than it was, 5 years ago during the end of the Clinton administration. And at the time, I seem to recall conservatives and all libertarians complained about the Clinton administration, said government was too big and too oppressive and too intrusive, frighteningly powerful. Well, it's about a third bigger now, and it has a lot more power now.
And they love it.
Hey, yeah, everybody. They love it.
It's Anthony Gregory on the Weekend Interview Show. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. The guest is Anthony Gregory from LouRockwell.com. And, you know, that song brings up the wonderful liberation of the Japanese. All it took was a couple of atom bombs. And look at how wonderful that situation has turned out, Anthony. Isn't that a great example of libervention achieving great wonders?
Well, there are a lot of poor parallels between the Japan and Germany situation. And what we're seeing now, the cultures of Japan and Germany were much different. Not that, I don't believe that some people are, it's culturally impossible for them to have freedom or anything. But, you know, they were more used to it. They were ready to surrender. They had just fought an apocalyptic battle with the Allies. It was the largest conflict in world history. And they were completely devastated. Japan, you know, the U.S. bombed and killed hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of civilians. Devastated many of their major cities. There's a good movie, The Fog of War, about McNamara, and it talks about this.
About the firebombing of Tokyo.
Yeah, and it shows images that are very. They really hit it home how much the country was devastated.
Well, and you bring up an important point, too, I think. You said culturally they were kind of used to that idea. The point there being that Japan had previously had a Western-style parliamentary type of system before the imperial military dictatorship had taken over. So going back to a parliament wasn't that big of a stretch as compared to going to some sort of republican form of government in Iraq after nothing but kings and dictators.
Sure, and both and a few other things is Japan and Germany, they both had these parliamentary systems. Germany was very democratic in many ways before World War One and after World War One, and though Hitler never got a democratic majority of the vote, despite some people say that he did, but he didn't. But it was a democratic process that brought him power. So
right, yeah, plurality is enough to get where he needed.
Yeah, we need to remember that democratic checks and balances are probably better than certain other kinds of autocratic rule, but they can still devolve. I mean, both of those turned into empires. Germany was one of the most sophisticated, cultural centers in the world. It was an amazing civilization that really went downhill.
Well, and what do you say to people who argue in the current situation that we can't just leave now? Even if, okay, there were no weapons of mass destruction or ties to Al-Qaeda, and apparently they don't like the liberty that we brought them very much. But we can't just turn around and leave, because it'll be a total disaster.
Well, you hear liberals saying this these days, which is really disconcerting. I think it reveals kind of an arrogance about the U.S. government's ability to bring freedom and to restore order. And it also reveals an ignorance of the failures of government to do good. The U.S. occupation isn't doing good. The idea that, just one more year of fighting, just a few more cleverly placed bombs, and a few more interventions, and then we can make up for all the mistakes that the U.S. government has made. It's really absurd. The U.S. government has made mistake after mistake in Iraq since at least the 80s. Before that, too. But, with the 80s, the U.S. was really helping Saddam in the war against
Anthony,
Iran.
Are you some kind of hippie? You sound very anti-American, young man.
Well, it's funny because in the 80s, if you had questioned the U.S. helping Saddam, you might have been called an anti-American. If you would have questioned the U.S. supplying him with chemical weapons and intelligence and funding after he gassed the people, after he committed all of his crimes against humanity, you would have probably been considered some kind of sympathizer to the Ayatollah, which, of course, Reagan only supported illegally and under the table. But it's really bizarre because when he was the worst, to oppose him and to oppose our support of him would have been considered the traitorous thing. Now, to oppose this stupid war is considered the same, though, the U.S. went in there and the Gulf War won, which was just as illegitimate and bogus, despite the claims that that war was good, but this war is bad and all that nonsense. And then throughout the 90s, those horrible sanctions, the freedom to trade, for individuals to trade with each other, it's a human right. And the U.S. was, through the U.N., was enforcing sanctions on Iraq, some of the most comprehensive and brutal sanctions in world history. And one thing I want to say real quickly before the break is, you talked about World War II. Yeah, Japan and West Germany at first were definitely better off than they were during the war, but in Eastern Europe and eventually Asia fell to the communists. So it's not like that was an unqualified success. It's hard to say we can replicate the good part of that war without the bad part. You've got to learn from the whole war.
It's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm talking with Anthony Gregory from LouRockwell.com and Strike the Root. And you were talking about how the World War, yeah, you can judge it was a great war if you lived in the western half of Europe or lived in Japan. But if you lived in Eastern Europe or in mainland Asia, you might not be so happy with the consequences of the good war.
Well, sure. What was the original goal of...
To stop fascism or totalitarianism, right?
Yeah. And what was the original goal of Britain in 1939 of declaring war? It was to liberate, Poland and Czechoslovakia and Eastern Europe from totalitarianism. But it stayed that way until, the Soviet Union and the communist system fell on its own weight. It's communism. One very reassuring fact for human freedom is that since oppression doesn't work very well, its time is always numbered. and, you know, communism couldn't have lasted forever, but still it was horrible. World War II, you know, West Germany and Japan, after the war, after their imperial takeovers and after the bombings by the U.S. and losing millions of people, were better off, probably. But, you know, it wasn't really better off for Eastern Europe. It wasn't better off ultimately for Asia. You know, Japan was stopped picking on China. And, you know, of course, Japan was a very brutal empire. It was murderous in the way that it treated its colonial subjects. But then China, you know, fell. It was first the nationalists and then fell to Mao. It wasn't, China wasn't liberated, not then anyway.
Oh, well, and all this just justified more intervention.
Right, exactly. That's the whole Cold War. See, World War One really created the conditions that led to World War Two, which created the conditions which led to the Cold War. And it was during the Cold War that the U.S. was helping all these shady terrorist people. You know, it was during the Cold War that the U.S. thought bin Laden and the Mujahideen in Afghanistan were potential freedom fighters. You know, if you had questioned support for them back in the 80s, I wonder if you would have been considered anti-American then, when you would have been right to question intervention then.
This is something that you've hit upon in your articles, actually, quite often, about being portrayed as always for the other side in any past policy you criticize. If you don't approve of the way Lincoln treated the Constitution and the question of secession, well, then you love slavery. And if you don't like Woodrow Wilson, then you love the Kaiser. And if you don't like FDR, then you love Hitler, and all the way through.
Well, this is one reason that governments and our presidents love war. They love fighting an enemy like the Kaiser or like Hitler, because, or Saddam Hussein, or someone that everyone knows is a bad guy. They get, you know, they can expand, the government does expand a lot, you know, for a war on poverty or a war on drugs, and these are horrible wars, these kind of euphemistic, well, not euphemistic, these kind of metaphorical wars, and they can be very horrible, and they can strip away our freedom, but nothing gets people riled up more than the idea of fighting a brutal dictator, fighting for freedom. Well, this is the oldest game in the book. When's the last war the U.S. had that wasn't supposedly in the name of freedom? Certainly the Civil War. The Spanish-American War was the first big Republican foreign war of freedom. I mean, McKinley and especially Teddy Roosevelt, these guys were like neocons, embryonic neocons. They were the first. And the Republicans and conservatives, you know, they were always warmongers back then. And they still are. There was a long period in the 20th century when it looked like the Democrats were the bigger international warmongers, but maybe that's changed again. But
implied that the Republicans were weaklings, and they're not going to put up with that.
Oh, yeah. No, they don't want to be seen as weak. When a weak government is exactly what our better founding fathers wanted. But, yeah, the Spanish-American War, World War One was supposed to make the whole world safe for democracy. Now, Bush has taken it further. He wants to make the world not just safe for democracy. He wants to make the world democratic. That's what he says anyway. And, of course, this is a brilliant move of politicians to wage war. They say they're waging war against these horrible monsters. And to disagree with a war has always been people who disagree with war have always been accused of sympathizing or even aiding the enemy. This is absurd because we all know that, yeah, sometimes these monsters are vanquished. And John Quincy Adams warned us that our government shouldn't be going abroad in search of monsters to destroy, but that's what we do. And a lot of times it's our government that creates these monsters in the first place. But we know that these wars affect, you know, everyday men, women, and children throughout the world. They affect American servicemen and women. They affect our pocketbooks and our civil liberties, our freedom of dissent, our economic well-being, the strength of the dollar.
Let's take a call, Anthony. We got Mike in Minnesota. You got a question for Mr. Gregory?
No, I've just been listening to the RBN all day today, and I just wanted to make a comment. They keep asking, where are the Christians? Where are the Christians in all this, these different things, like the Terry Schiavo thing and things like that? I just wanted to say that the last couple of years I've been kind of looking for a church that I feel comfortable with, and the message I'm getting from all these churches are, hey, you know, the end times are near. Just sit back and relax and welcome it. And that's what seems to be going on in this country today.
Yeah, well, I think you're probably right, but you got the wrong show. But
okay.
Anyway, thanks a lot for the call. Anthony, what do you say? Should we just sit back and wait on Armageddon?
Well, I mean, I don't want to get too much into a theological discussion, but I don't think that I don't think we should just sit around waiting for Armageddon. I don't think Armageddon is inevitable. Or
well, let me put this in a little more realistic context. What is it that makes you want to get up and write these articles and do these interviews and work so hard to teach people about liberty when, you know, surely you could have a really good job making lots of money and have a leather couch and a real comfortable house and live in your little bubble? After all, you can still basically live a pretty free life in the United States right now. So the question is, why not just sit back and wait for whatever it is?
Well, you know, though I'm not her biggest fan, one thing that Ayn Rand once said that I think is very astute is that just because you have no interest in politics doesn't mean politics has no interest in you. You can try to avoid it, and chances are you'll probably come out okay, but a lot of people end up being caught in the crosshairs. I was first interested in freedom long before this war on terrorism. I was very much against war back then, too, but I was concerned, you know, about things like the drug war and gun control and tax policy and people losing their homes because they filled out the form wrong and people being taxed into poverty and
having all their money taken from them at the airport on no probable cause whatsoever.
Sure, and healthcare declining rapidly when more government intervention is piled on top of old government intervention, which caused the prices to go up in the first place. And, you know, you could just sit by and watch it, but I believe in liberty, and I want to see America have more of the freedoms that it used to have, and actually I'd like to see it be freer than it ever has been. I think it's possible. It doesn't always look like a reason to be optimistic, but I'm hopeful. I'd like to see it happen, so, you know, I just say what I believe. I'd like to say real fast about the last caller. He talked about Christians who are, they seem to have resigned themselves to the idea of apocalypse. Well, a lot of Christians have also, unfortunately, been very pro-war lately. There's a wonderful book by Lawrence Vance, just came out, Christianity and War. He's another writer on lewrockwell.com. And it has a bunch of essays in there about why Christians should oppose war, why war contradicts Christian principles. And
it is a great book. I've read it. In fact, I think I'm hopefully going to interview Mr. Vance on the show next week.
Oh, terrific.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
I've interviewed him once before, in fact, at weekendinterviewshow.com. There's an archive, I think.
Yeah, so
maybe
people,
it's my old show.
So anyone who is kind of on the fence about the war but has strong Christian beliefs, or anyone who's just interested in that perspective. It's a good book.
Or have Christian friends and family members who are pro-war who you'd like to show them, you know, another point of view. It is, after all, it's pretty hard to convince people who maybe aren't necessarily up on all the details of what's happening, but they know that the pro-war side is pickup trucks and blue jeans, and the anti-war side is white kids with dreadlocks sitting in the street blocking traffic. Who are you going to side with? And so, I mean, seriously, that's the way people think sometimes. And so I think it's a great thing to have somebody like Lawrence Vance, who is a Southern evangelical Christian and who could not be more against the war or more for Jesus.
No, yeah, no, it's awesome. It's very touching and powerful writing because, and of course this, you know, a lot of Christians have been very good about, the war, but others have kind of gone the way of Jerry Falwell, who has some pretty crazy articles. One that, Lawrence Vance talks about is he's got this article that's, Jerry Falwell does, that's called God is Pro-War.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but you'll get, I'm sure you'll talk, if you have him on the show, you'll talk about that, but be sure to bring that up, because that's some daring stuff to say, you know, God is pro-war.
Yeah, well, there were people, I remember when Clear Channel was having all the pro-war protests, or anti-war protests, or whatever they were. There was a woman down in San Antonio, and I think this picture ended up being distributed all over the world, of this woman in at this Clear Channel rally in San Antonio with a giant sign that said, God is on George Bush's side.
Well, you know, that's another...
Not even that he's on God's side, but God's on his side.
Yeah, God has signed on. Well, that's another, this is one of the problems with the Republicans, and when they have power, is a lot of conservatives who, during Democratic administrations, are much more skeptical of the federal government and central power and even war, they get tricked. And a lot of libertarians, I'm sad to say, get tricked too, because Republicans talk about bringing freedom over the world. They talk about free markets. They talk about how our money is our money and it's not the government's.
Ownership society, right?
Yeah. And yeah, exactly. They have a much more, I'd say, dishonest and sneaky rhetorical approach. Bush says, he said in his 2000 campaign, I don't know if he still says it, but he said, you know, it's your money and I'm here to get you a refund. Well, thanks, Mr. President. If it's our money, why don't you give it all back?
Only need about $2.5 trillion a year of it, and you can have the rest.
Yeah, why are you asking for more than they've ever spent? Why are you asking for $2.57 trillion? I mean, that number boggles the mind.
Well, and you know, when you look at the libertarian right, I guess, the interventionist wing, the pro-Bush wing of libertarianism, you know, it could give a real bad picture of what it means to be a libertarian. I got an email the other day from a guy, hey, I love your show, I'm a radical left-winger, but I really like your show anyway. If you're a libertarian, the libertarians are all right. And I thought, well, you know, I hope this kid doesn't go surfing around too far, because he's going to find some people who call themselves libertarians who really, you know, seem to me like they're just Republicans who like boys and or like to smoke pot. But other than that, they're just Republicans, most of them.
They're Republicans who are liberal on drugs and sex and stuff like that, maybe. But in the Bay Area, and especially in Berkeley, I've met many liberals and many leftists, and a good number of them, when I tell them about pro-war libertarians, so-called, they say, what? That doesn't even make any sense, because they understand the philosophical implications of libertarianism better than some self-proclaimed libertarians do. But on the other hand, many say, oh, you're a libertarian? Well, that means, so you're all into, you know, war, and you think torture is not as bad as the minimum wage. You think that bombing cities you say you're for small government. I say, no, I'm a libertarian. Those people are conservatives of some type, or they're warmongers, or maybe they're modern liberals or war socialists. I don't know what they are, but I'd prefer to think that, you know, libertarianism grounded in the non-aggression principle, you don't initiate force, and grounded also in a healthy skepticism of government power and its capability of doing good, and skepticism of politicians, would lead one to question war and to be more cautious about war than pretty much anything else. It's the biggest government program. It's the only one that I know of that involves killing innocent people just from the get-go. That's like part of the... If a war goes well, you know, innocent people get killed.
It's funny, you know, Joe Sobrin on this show said that conservatives only like big government when it's shooting people. But really, that's not true. Conservatives love big government all the time, don't they?
Yeah, and especially if it's shooting people, then they'll put up with anything else it does.
Because, see, I've heard a lot of people say, well, I support Bush on the war, but, you know, on the rest of it, I agree, he really has betrayed conservatism. He really hasn't been conservative on the rest of the stuff. But on the war, you know, I got to stick with him on that. Anyway, it's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Anthony Gregory from LouRockwell.com. And when we come back, we'll talk about what a bunch of communists the Republicans are. Stay tuned. It's the Republic Broadcasting Network. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Anthony Gregory. He writes for the Independent Institute, Antiwar.com, LouRockwell.com, the Future Freedom Foundation, Rational Review, the Libertarian Enterprise, Liberty Magazine, and Strike the Root. And he writes incredible stuff. I especially recommend his archives at LouRockwell.com and at StrikeTheRoot.com. Now, Anthony, before the break, we were talking about the Bush administration's domestic policy, all their interventionism in Wilsonian fashion overseas, notwithstanding. In terms of their domestic policy, people often say that they're afraid that they have to admit that Bush, in fact, is not very conservative when it comes to domestic policy.
Well, it really depends on what conservative means. If by conservative you mean, you know, frugal, small government, you know, the Russell Kirk tradition, what some people, you know, call paleoconservatives, though even paleoconservatives tend to be interventionist in some areas like trade. If you're talking about, you know, the small government conservatism, which I think is a smaller movement historically than a lot of libertarians and conservatives would really like to believe, then no, he's not a conservative on foreign policy or domestic. He's a big government liberal. But if we want to go back further and talk about the original meanings of liberal and conservative, he is a conservative. Conservatives were the, you know, it was the right wing that invented the welfare state. It was Bismarck of Prussia who invented Social Security, who had really pushed for nationalized public schooling. And all this stuff went right along with the warfare state. It was regimenting society, taking care of people from cradle in the grave, and occasionally assigning them to be cannon fodder for the regime. And it's very nationalist. It harkens back to tradition. It pretends to have concern about family values. It is usually very comfortable with religion, but in a very kind of status top-down way, you know. And it's also not as explicitly opposed to private business and to corporations and profits as is the left. But in fact, in the American experience, you used to have, you know, in the very beginning, the Jeffersonian classic liberals and the Hamiltonians, the Federalists, who believed in big government, a strong central bank, they believed in big business, too, just like today's Republicans. And the Republicans have always been the party of big business and big government, whereas the Democrats used to be the party of small government, which supposedly would lead to smaller business. But then, you know, Wilson totally changed that forever, and the Democrats became the party of big government, supposedly to help the little guy. But now, I mean, they're basically the same party now, but you know, the Republicans have certainly always been, and conservatism has always been, you know, a big government, warmongering philosophy.
There you have it. Anthony
Gregory. Except maybe in the '90s, but maybe if we have another Democrat, it'll change again. But
yeah, well, good luck with that. we can see just how good they did with that contract on America. We're all so much better off.
Yeah.
All right, my friends. Anthony Gregory writes for Lou Rockwell, Strike the Root, Antiwar.com, Libertarian Enterprise, Independent Institute, Rational Review, Future Freedom Foundation, and Liberty Magazine. Look him up and read what he writes. We'll be right back with Tom Barry on the Weekend Interview Show.